listening to WGXC ACRA, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM.
Do you enjoy the arts, have an interest in art classes and meeting your local creative community? Then join us at the Athens Cultural Center on the first Friday of each month from 5 to 7 p.m. View our latest exhibition over free nibbles and drinks hosted by our ACC board members, and get to know us. We are at 24 2nd Street in Athens and online at athensculturalcenter.org. We look forward to meeting you.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at WGXC.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org/donate now.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Leah Bertucci of Ridgewood, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. Kate Lisa reports for New York State of Politics that state lawmakers held a hearing on October 30th, wondering why New York's legal cannabis industry has had so many problems getting started. The state has issued more than 460 retail licenses issued to business owners, but only 27 legal dispensaries opened 2.5 years after legalization. Senate Cannabis Subcommittee Chair Jerry Cooney said there's at least 25,000 pounds of cannabis legally grown in New York last season that's unsold and losing potency. Office of Cannabis Management Executive Director Chris Alexander told lawmakers on October 30th that, and I quote, "Obviously the retail footprint is not sufficient at the moment, and I don't run from that fact. We've got to open more stores," end quote. Clearly, there are more legal cannabis stores in New York than authorized outlets. OCM says it has raided about 300 illegal stores in the 5 months since it got more enforcement power. Cooney also said, and I quote, "If we do not speed this process up, if we do not address the lack of retail access in the state, both upstate and downstate, then the illicit market will continue to overcome and overtake the legal market. We've seen that in other states. We can't let that happen here in New York," end quote. Read more about this story in New York State Politics. Lana Bellamy reports in the Times Union that the town of Hurley's closed landfill in Ulster County has been added to the state's list of Superfund sites, which means access to more than $1 million of state remediation funds to clean up PFOS and PFOA at the site. The site is listed as Class O2, meaning it presents a, and I quote, "significant threat to public health and or the environment," end quote, because of PFOS and PFOA contamination. The so-called forever chemicals don't easily break down and are toxic to humans. The Hurley landfill operated from the 1960s to the mid-1990s. And you can read more about this story in the Times Union. The Daily Freeman reports that CSX will close a railroad crossing in Saugerties next week for repairs. The railroad crossing on Ulster Avenue, also called State Route 212, will close for repairs on Monday, November 6 until November 8. Police said the, and I quote, roadway and crossing will be closed. All traffic should seek an alternate route. CXX will keep us up to date if there are any changes to the repair schedule, end quote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, October 31st. Local early morning temperatures range from 30 freezing degrees in Tannersville to 37 in Kinderhook. Despite that, the regional average soil temperature is 57 degrees. Coupled with low wind activity today, that is keeping our homes a bit warmer than they would be with these air temperatures in, say, a month. Patch up those holes now. Give the critters a chance to find a new home before winter sets in. And get those winterizing kits from the store before the shelves empty out. Today's very cold morning turns chilly by 2 p.m. when we get a high of 46 degrees. Remember, those calm winds are on your side, but still a great idea to layer up, especially for the little door-to-door solicitors released on the population this evening. 32 degrees overnight takes us into a questionable Wednesday. Icing is not predicted, but low temperatures and random light precipitation are, so the conditions are there. Note, I said precip. That means some will get rain, some will see snowflakes. Hopefully, no one sees ice, but beware, surface ice can come out of nowhere and it is deadly. Anywho, we see a high of 45 and the day ends on a dreary side. Then, brr, overnight we see 29 degrees and bounce back to 50 Thursday afternoon. Friday, still dry, looks like a high of 54. It'll be windy, so plan outside activities accordingly. Speaking of outside, today's tide schedule is high tide at 5:16 a.m., low tide at 11:38 a.m., high tide once again at 5:30 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 56 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 5:39 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:23 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances have jumped to 5%. Plasma winds will be average at 502 kilometers per second with a thin density of 2 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently far below 8 megahertz till dark, then far below 60 megahertz overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 62. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
You're tuned to Radio Art, creative transmissions, sound experiments, noise, and more on WGXC 90.7 FM Acre.
Hello, and welcome to Food Segment, where I investigate food places and tell you all about my discoveries. I was curious to find out more about gourds and what everyone was doing with them. So I embarked on a mission to get closer to these odd and sometimes edible fruits. When I saw all of the gourds at Max Morningstar Farm Store at 5956 New York 9H in Hudson, I swerved my car off of the road. Every surface is covered with pumpkins or gourds. There were gourds of every shape and color. Some of the gourds were blue.
There are ones that are blue and orange.
Overwhelmed, I headed inside to ask for more information.
On our farm, we grow a few types of pumpkins. We have your regular jack-o'-lanterns. We grow orange ones and yellow ones and white ones. And then we grow very cute little gourds for decorative purposes because those are not edible.
A gourd expert was willing to answer some of my questions.
These are heirloom varieties that are grown for both decorative purposes and edible purposes. So we'll grow Musse de Provence and the Galop de Cygne. We have Long Island cheese pumpkin, the Marina di Chioggia. These are all very good squashes to eat.
Wow.
Also to decorate with.
But she seemed perplexed when I asked her why there are so many gourds.
Why are there so many of these pumpkins and squash, like, everywhere?
Just so many varieties, or?
Just, like, how do they get so many? How do you get so many of them?
Oh, well, we grow a lot.
After some online research, I found out about Jackson's old Chatham house, which has a squash ravioli in pumpkin cream sauce on their menu. While I was on my way there, I made a pit stop at the Stewart's on Route 66 to see if their seasonal ice cream flavors had dropped.
I would say it does taste a lot like pumpkin pie.
I ordered a scoop of the pumpkin pie flavor.
There's definitely nutmeg.
I made another pit stop at Martin's Farm Stand across the road from Stewart's, where I picked up a pumpkin custard pie, a pumpkin whoopie pie, and one of those ethereal blue pumpkins I kept spotting.
What? The blue pumpkins? What are those? Oh, yeah, that looks like it.
Jaredale.
My blue pumpkin was squat with asymmetrical curvature so that it reminded me of a pumpkin that a witch would have. With my Jaredale pumpkin and the pies in my passenger seat, I arrived at Jackson's Old Chatham House at 646 Albany Turnpike in Old Chatham.
Jackson's Old Chatham House restaurant in a old house. It reminds me of, like, old.
The building's from, like, 1800s.
Oh, wow.
It was, like a shop, you know, a blacksmith shop and a store.
Wow. It was built in the 1800s.
The dining room is dark with wooden columns, an expansive bar, and a painting of a terrier with a crown on its head. I ordered the ravioli with pumpkin cream sauce and inquired about the pumpkin liqueur that I saw on their bar.
Pumpkin pie martini.
Pumpkin pie martini.
I ate my ravioli on their patio.
So the ravioli are sweet, nutmeg, cinnamon, possibly a little bit of cheese, the inside. Butternut puree, tender, almost has like a ice cream.
The ravioli are extra large, square, and the color of egg yolk. The pumpkin cream sauce is speckled with cinnamon and nutmeg. A white pickup truck full of gourds drove by.
There's a truck passing full of gourds.
The next day, I got a hot tip about squash pizza at Tommy B's Slice Shop at 1817 New York 23 in Craryville, New York. So I headed there immediately. It was a scenic autumnal drive.
the trees are orange and yellow and red and green.
Tommy B's is on the side of the road next to an Ameristop gas station.
It's just a pizza shop, and it's next to an Ameristop gas station.
I headed inside and asked for a slice of the sassy squash, which is listed on the menu with a provolone mozzarella blend of cheese, butternut squash, red onion, bacon, sage, and hot honey.
I heard that you have a squash pizza.
Yes, we're ordering one right now. I don't have any slices. You can throw a whole pie, or...
I just wanted a slice, if that's possible.
Yeah, we can take one. It takes about 6 or 7 minutes.
Yeah, cool. I can just wait. I'll come back.
And yeah, all right, cool, man. Yeah.
They didn't have one ready, so the pizza person prepared a whole fresh sassy squash pizza while I waited. I chatted with the pizza preparer and the order taker.
New York style slice shop.
Yeah, New York thing. I know, we do a lot of pan pizzas.
Oh, okay.
We do a Detroit pie, we do a pan pizza, like Pizza Hut.
Who were very friendly and supportive about my gourd journey.
So how did you see that we're doing a squash pizza?
A friend of mine told me, because I've been looking for, I'm doing a project about squash.
At Tommy B's, you can order your pizza as a pan pizza, or prepared in the New York thin crust style.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
It was piping hot with a crispy, toothsome crust, thick half moons of butternut squash, and speckled with onion, bacon, sage, and hot honey. The sweetness of the squash and honey was complemented by the spiciness of the onion and the smokiness of the bacon. When I arrived home, my dining companion and I sampled the pumpkin custard pie and the pumpkin whoopie pie from Martin's Farm Fresh Farm Stand at 812 New York 9H.
It is like flan, like a pumpkin flan with a crust.
Yeah, it's really nice and moist.
The pumpkin custard pie had a thin, delicate crust, a layer of pumpkin and another layer of custard underneath a golden brown surface.
And there's a layer of pumpkin on the bottom, and then in the middle top, there's more custard.
The whoopie pie was two layers of pumpkin cake in the shape of muffin tops with a sweet vanilla frosting in the middle.
Soft pumpkin muffin top cake with almost like a vanilla frosting inside. Which is really moist, but not overspiced.
My appetite for gourds was expanding, so I changed into formal wear and headed to Feast and Floret at 13 South 3rd Street in Hudson to try their wood-fired squash. My dining companion and I were seated in the smaller of their two candlelit indoor dining rooms. Our spacious table almost touched the public-facing side of their bar area, which is well-stocked with eclectic and sophisticated cocktail ingredients. Just above my head, I could see a bottle of Don Julio 1942, which I recognized from a recent episode of The Kardashians.
I 100% completely understand.
There were two squash dishes on the menu that night.
Between that and the delicata squash, which one do you like?
Delicata is really interesting. Really nice sweet flavors right now. Take the seeds from the squash itself and dry the seeds. Blend that with some nice fresh herbs on top. Makes it really nice and bright.
We ordered the delicata squash in a sauce made from the delicata seeds.
Okay, so they're in half moons. The delicata squash is a light yellow squash with striped, like a striped skin.
The delicata was served in half ringlets in an elegant ceramic bowl. They were coated in coarse brown seed sauce and sprinkled with chopped mint and parsley.
Did they say this was cooked in the wood flame?
I wasn't really listening.
Can't remember. It does have sort of a smoky flavor.
The squash was tender, but not soft. Its light orange flesh was pleasantly sweet, cut with the nuttiness of the seed puree and a hint of wood smoke. Still hungry, my gourd expedition led me back to my own kitchen, where I decided to create my own gourd dish. Squachos. I took the difficult step of cutting into my beautiful Jarredale pumpkin with a large cleaver. Underneath its steel skin was a bright orange flesh that smelled like cantaloupe.
Oh, wow.
I scooped out the seeds, roasted my pumpkin, and pureed it with garlic, onions, peppers, and nutritional yeast to make a smooth sauce reminiscent of queso cheese. I poured the squash sauce over a layer of tortilla chips and topped it with black beans, cilantro, and pickled onions.
And I'm going to call it squachos.
My journey had ended, and I had gotten closer than I had ever been to pumpkins and squash. I finally knew for myself the power of gourd. Thank you for listening to Food Segment on WGXC.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're talking with Ashley Ingram, who's an associate attorney for the Earth Justice Sustainable Food and Farming Program. And there are a number of key environmental bills, the Community Gardens Protection Act, Birds and Bees, and Class C Streams, that have not yet passed the state legislature, not yet been signed by the governor. So, you know, Ashley, do you want to introduce us to a couple of these bills and why they're important?
Sure. So I think just to set the stage, New York has set itself out as a leader on climate and environmental justice issues. And we think that the legislature took important steps this past session in passing some really critical environmental laws that are now waiting for the governor's signature. So one of these bills is the Community Gardens Protection Act. And this bill would support community gardens that are on publicly owned land by increasing some of the protections and increasing community involvement in decisions that might involve development or other decisions that could harm those gardens. Another of the bills is
now, before I jump away, when you say on publicly owned land, does that mean state-owned land or any municipally owned land?
State or municipally owned land.
Okay.
So what it would do is it would have the state's Community Gardens Task Force evaluate whether these gardens qualify as what are known as critical environmental areas. Do they provide critical environmental services to the community? And if they do, then they get some special consideration and include more of the community in the process if there are any decisions that might disrupt the garden.
And so the Birds and Bees Protection Act?
Yes, so this is a bill that would ban certain types of really harmful and unnecessary uses of a neurotoxic pesticide known as neonicotinoids. So these are this pesticide is the leading cause of losses of our pollinators. So that's why it's the Birds and Bees Protection Act. But it also spreads really easily through our food, our soil, and our water. And so it affects entire ecosystems, and it's really dangerous for our health, especially for young children.
Yeah, I understand that some agriculture-related groups have been opposing this bill. How is the, you know, what are their arguments, and how has the governor responded to that so far, if at all?
Yes, so we have seen pushback from some of the pesticide industry and some of the industrial farm groups arguing that, one, that there's not enough seeds that aren't treated with these pesticides to grow for farmers to use, and then also saying that this could lead to a collapse of our agricultural system. But I think it's really important to know that a Cornell report found that these pesticides actually provide no overall economic benefit for farmers, and that a similar ban was passed just over the border in Quebec and Ontario and a few years ago, and they have seen none of these disastrous effects coming out to play. And so I think and also in terms of protecting our food supply, it's really important that we have these pollinators who are able to support our food and agricultural system, including crops like apples and grapes and pumpkins that are all dependent on pollinators. And there was a recent report that came out that said that the decline in pollinators has already led to a decline in our food production. So it's really important for our health and our safety and our food system to take action on these neonics.
Now, I remember a few years ago, there was quite a lot of attention to the fact that, many beehives and bee colonies were dying off. And I assume these pesticides had probably some role in that. Has that type of situation stabilized, or is still a massive die-off of pollinators?
I think the last number that I saw was that there's been a 50% decline in both beekeeping colonies and also the wild bee population as well. And so that's continuing to decline, unfortunately. And so that's another reason why urgent action is needed.
Hmm. And what about the Class C Strains Protection Act?
Yes, so this bill would amend New York's water regulatory protection system to include what are known as Class C streams. So these are smaller streams that usually support fisheries and other kinds of non-contact recreation, so picnicking, camping, fishing, marine study. And so and these streams are also really important for drinking water because they restore the underground aquifers that a lot of communities rely on for their groundwater, for drinking water. So this would just expand the protections for those streams. And this is really critical given the recent Supreme Court decision in Sackett versus EPA, which limited what the Clean Water Act can cover at a federal level to protect our water. So we really need New York to take leadership and make sure that these streams are protected.
So when one says a Class C stream, is there any way to describe the size of it, or how could somebody know whether a stream running through their land actually is a Class C stream or not?
So the New York Department of Environmental Conservation has a map online that you can look up the water streams in your area and see exactly what type of designation they have. But these typically are smaller streams, but they connect to larger water bodies as well. And so important for all of our water health.
Now, is there any real opposition to the Class C Strains Protection Act?
So there has been some pushback in the past just about the regulatory burden that this would create for the state and for towns. But I think that this bill has taken some steps to reduce that regulatory burden. And we've also seen some increased funding and staffing levels for DEC through the Green Bond Act that could help relieve some of the concerns around that.
Now, if our listeners wanted to express their opinion, you know, one way or the other, about the Community Gardens Protection Act, the birds and bees, and the Class C streams, how best can they do that?
Yes, so these bills are waiting for the governor's signature, and so people who are interested in expressing their support could contact the governor. Earth Justice has put together an action alert on these three bills that could be used. You can find it through a quick internet search, Earth Justice Take Action Governor Hochul, and it should be one of the first results that come up. But there's a message there that you can personalize to express why these bills are important for you personally.
Now, I didn't ask this question before, but on the Community Gardens Protection Act, I remember 15, 20 years ago, a big fight with the mayor of New York City, who wanted to grab a lot of community gardens to, in his words, you know, build more affordable housing. But, you know, where does opposition to, you know, protecting community gardens come from, if at all?
Yes, so I think that there are different large developers who are interested in this land, and there aren't a lot of protections that already exist for community gardens. I think one thing that I'll say is that this bill doesn't prevent any development in particular. It just means that community gardens who are designated as critical environmental areas, that those benefits that the community garden provides have to be taken into account in any decisions.
So we've been talking to Ashley Ingram, Earth Justice Sustainable Food and Farming Program, and that's Community Gardens Protection Act, Birds and Bees Protection Act, and Class C Streams Protection Act. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Samhain is a pagan festival celebrated from October 31st to November 1st to welcome in the harvest and usher in the dark half of the year. This festival has a lot of commonalities with other festivals we may be more familiar with, and it's my pleasure to welcome back Laura Welsh from Fehu Farm to better understand what Samhain is. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. So Samhain is the festival that marks, like you said, the dark part of the year starting, and it happens on October 31st overnight until the 1st of November. And it's a Gaelic holiday that has been celebrated for thousands of years. And the reason it's so significant is this time of the year is considered the time when the border between the world of the living and the world of the dead is the thinnest. So it's a time when people who are alive have an opportunity to sort of interact and reach out to that spirit realm.
You mentioned Gaelic, and it's often referred to as Celtic. Do you know what the difference is between Gaelic and Celtic?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I think Celtic is sort of a broader term and covers a larger region, and Gaelic is specific to, like, Ireland. And it's also a language, so right. There's that distinction there. But there's a lot of... Samhain traditions, I think, are practiced in, like, the general Celtic world as well, as just Ireland. A lot of the traditions that we think of as Halloween actually come from the Samhain traditions that were brought with Irish immigrants to the United States. So things like dressing up in costume is one of the traditions, because when the veil is thin and you want to welcome spirits, obviously you want to welcome friendly ones, but that doesn't mean that those are the only ones that come across. So dressing up to sort of scare away evil is the root of that sort of like trick-or-treating Halloween dressing up tradition. And another tradition that's super important is sort of making an altar to those who have passed on, and honoring them by either like putting out their favorite foods, putting out pictures, lighting candles. There's a tradition called the dummy supper, where you sort of set a table to invite guests who are not physically present anymore, and just sort of like invite them to dinner and have your dinner along with these empty seats that, you know, on this time it's believed that the spirits of our loved ones can sort of come back and visit with us.
So the connections between Halloween and Dia de los Muertos are so obvious. And so it really shows that, as in like a borderless world, things really aren't so separate in belief systems, and the evolution of migration, and how, you know, you think of Mexico and you think of Ireland, and okay, there's also influence from Spain. Really, we all have similar belief systems and come to this similar idea of like the changing of the year and ways of ritualing and thinking about our ancestors. What do you take away from that?
Yeah, I think that like this time of year, like why would the veil be so thin, and why are we perceiving that as humans? And it comes up in a bunch of cultures, I think, because we can see, I mean, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, this is the time where the light is decreasing, where the plants that aren't evergreen are all like either dying off or going into the ground for the season. So that connection to like this, the overall cycle of life, is very powerful right now. So the darkness and the return to the earth, it just seems like the right time to be thinking about those who have passed on. And there's a lot of like All Hallows Eve and All Saints Day are sort of Christian traditions that reflect that same sort of reverence of the dead. You know, and like All Saints Day, obviously it's specifically saints, but it's this idea that at this time of year, when everything is sort of returning to the earth and quieter, like the living world is quieter, there's other voices and other influences that are able to permeate our awareness. And taking time to make sure we like acknowledge that is super important.
Right. That makes sense. You mentioned the costumes, and I thought it was very interesting that when the veil is thinner, that people would dress as animals and monsters so that fairies were not tempted to kidnap them, thinking they were people and their family, and the family wants to take them to the afterlife, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like actually carving pumpkins is part of that tradition too, sort of like a gargoyle almost, like creating something that's scary. And in, you know, the British Isles, pumpkins weren't like a plant that was super common, but that's sort of like the blending of, you know, the tradition coming to the United States is using these sort of indigenous gourds as part of the decoration and warding off of evil spirits. And that's why you put like the light inside of the jack-o'-lantern too, because the light is sort of scaring off like the negative energies.
So Samhain is considered the most significant of the four quarterly fire festivals in paganism. So firstly, what is a quarterly fire festival? And then secondly, why is it considered the most important?
The fire festivals mark the points that are halfway between the equinoxes and the solstices. So the other, like the opposite of Samhain, is Beltane, which is like the spring fire festival at the opposite side of the year. Samhain is the most important because the placement of these fire festivals relate to the shepherding cycle. So Beltane was when all of the like herd animals were brought out to pasture, and then Samhain is the time of year where everything gets brought back in and shut down for the year, and so the fire in Samhain comes from the term bonfire. It actually is like a shortening of bone fire, because at this time of year, if you couldn't provide for all of the animals that you had out to pasture, the ones that you couldn't provide for over the winter were slaughtered for meat. And so the bones of those animals were burned in a sacred fire, which was the Samhain bone fire, bonfire. And so it was sort of like a ritual that was thanking the animals for their sacrifice, so you could survive for the winter. And this sacred fire, like people would take flames like on a candle or something and bring it back to their house and light their hearths with that fire and try and keep it going for as long as possible. So the reason that this particular festival is so significant is because of the connections to surviving through the winter and the connections to loved ones who have passed on, because like having the opportunity to touch base with someone on the other side is, you know, obviously like a very impactful thing, and something you need to take time out of regular life to achieve.
What do you want people to understand about Samhain? And is there something in particular that you think is a really wonderful ritual that we should hold on to?
I think one of the best things that we could like take as a tradition of Samhain going forward is trying to meditate on those things which are just slightly beyond our regular perception. Because I feel like we still celebrate this time of year, you know, even in modern culture, as sort of like a special spiritual time. And we can feel that energy. And I think like trying to actually make time to tap into that by finding quiet and dark and separate moments to just listen and try and connect with things that are not as obvious in our day-to-day life is really important. And it's also a good time to sort of like seek wisdom or like seek guidance from the other side. And you can do that just, you know, like through like basic prayer if you don't want to use any tools. But there's also, you know, divinatory tools that are super effective at this time of year. Like if you do tarot or if you read runes, you can kind of reach out. Like the spirit world is just closer. And I find that when I do magic or when I do sort of like divination work at this time of year, I get like the really good answers, you know. So I think that there is still like trying to still make those connections with the ethereal and with the things that are just like, we know that they are real, but it's hard to remember that in just like life.
And for those who maybe don't connect with this type of communication, just even thinking within yourself and maybe thinking about the wisdom of your ancestors might be a good path.
Yeah, definitely. Because even if you, you know, like the more sort of spiritual and magical side of it doesn't speak to you, just sort of like looking to your past and researching about where your roots are and stuff like that, it's just can be really fun and interesting way to just learn more about yourself.
Laura Welsh, always a pleasure to have you on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Would you like to leave our listeners with anything that I forgot to ask about?
I think we covered most of the stuff, but if you are interested in learning more about witchcraft, you could check out our Instagram at fehu_farmstand or email us at fehufarmstand@gmail.com.
And that's F-E-H-U. Thank you.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Stack yards appear before me. Windy City don't look so good from here. You leave me with the FM radio. FM radio, the only one I've ever known. I can't breathe in this red fog.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Jamal Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that on October 25th, the Columbia County Board of Supervisors Finance Committee unanimously agreed to make the First Reformed Church of Hudson a warming shelter for the homeless on cold winter days. The full Board of Supervisors are expected to vote on the issue on November 8th. Board of Supervisors Chair Matt Morrell said, "I hope it works out. This is the first time we're trying it. People can come out of the cold and get a warm meal and possibly have a place to stay for the night. It can house up to 10 to 15 per bunk, and it will be an alternative for our homeless population," end quote. Social Services Commissioner Robert Gibson said the warming shelter would open during code blue declarations when it is extremely cold. Gibson said, and I quote, "The code blue population won't come in or apply, or they have some issues in the past. Maybe they're under a sanction from one of the state agencies. They're usually suffering from a multitude of issues. We're probably looking at somewhere between 10 to 15 people that will be housed using code blue funding," end quote. Gibson said the program will cost between $190,000 to $200,000, and he hopes the program can start at the beginning of 2024. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Patricia R. Doxey reports in the Daily Freeman that cannabis fans, marijuana-growing farmers, and towns expecting tax revenue all want the same thing to happen in New York. Farmer Tessa Williams said, and I quote, "I would plead with Governor Hochul to open stores. We need stores to open," end quote. 2.5 years after cannabis was legalized in the state, very few stores are legally selling it, and none locally. About 300 farmers across New York have grown much cannabis that is slowly going bad. As of October 26, there are only 21 retail cannabis dispensaries open across the state, most in New York City. The closest locally is in Albany. Williams says her 220-acre Empire Farm in Columbia County invested $3 million to start growing cannabis and has been stuck with the crop. Williams said, and I quote, "We farmers, we pivot," end quote. So they began selling the crop at events after Governor Kathy Hochul's administration loosened rules recently to help farmers with their glut of cannabis. Hochul's administration also recently further opened the application process. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Liz Montgomery reports for Porcupine Soup that Greenville Central School District students will no longer have to pay for school meals beginning November 1st. A free breakfast and a free lunch are now available to all students there. The district said in a statement, and I quote, "After a lengthy application process, the district was approved to participate in the community-eligible provision after the U.S. Department of Agriculture expanded access by schools to the federal CEP of the National School Lunch Program," end quote. Before, at least 40% of the students had to live in households participating in certain income-based federal assistance programs to be eligible for the free meal program, but that was lowered to 25% recently, allowing Greenville to participate. Catskill, Cairo-Durham, and Hunter-Tannersville schools already participate in the program. And you can read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 update. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Something is relevant that that I will likely allow the subject to be explored. I will not, however, allow this proceeding to turn into a circus.
Colorado District Judge Sarah B. Wallace is laying down ground rules for the hearing on whether former President Donald Trump can be blocked from the state's ballot. The 14th Amendment says anyone who took an oath to uphold the Constitution but then engages in rebellion is disqualified from office. The former president's critics say the January 6th riot means that applies to Trump, despite his lead in the polls. An AP University of Chicago survey finds voters across party lines lack confidence in election security and legitimacy. Fewer than half of all Americans say they're confident their vote for president will be counted accurately. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation says this may be tied to election disinformation.
Unlike previous elections, we had a candidate at the top of the ballot running for president who has continued to spread lies about the election and really targeted his sincerely disappointed supporters in an effort to raise money, and others have also grifted off of those lies.
Earlier polls have shown two-thirds of Republicans say President Joe Biden's win in the 2020 election wasn't legitimate. Biden gave up his spot on the New Hampshire primary ballot after working with the National Party to put South Carolina's primary first. But with Minnesota Representative Dean Phillips now in the race, some in the Granite State are starting a Biden write-in campaign to make sure the president doesn't lose an early contest. Kathleen Sullivan, former chair of the state party, says this will also help New Hampshire folks show their independence, including from the National Democratic Party.
They're not going to stop New Hampshire Democrats from going out and voting. We're going to do that, no matter what some National Democrats may want.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul wants more efforts to keep people safe from anti-Semitic attacks. Hochul told a group of Cornell University students that people should have the right to feel safe anywhere.
No one should be afraid to walk from their dorm or their dining hall to a classroom. That is a basic right that every New Yorker has outside of campus, but particularly on a campus, because these are young people who are in an environment that is intended to protect them as well.
During 16 days in October, the Anti-Defamation League charted more than 300 anti-Semitic incidents, nearly two-thirds directly linked to the Israel-Hamas war. In the same period last year, the ADL tracked fewer than 70 incidents. Vermont Democratic Congresswoman Rebecca Ballant is sponsoring a resolution to censure Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene. Ballant cited Greene's hate speech and promotion of conspiracy theories.
Whereas members of Congress have promised to always have the back of Marjorie Taylor Greene, no matter the extent of her vile and hateful behavior, now therefore be it resolved that Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene be censured.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A federal district court has found that the state of Georgia's congressional voting district map is in violation of the Voting Rights Act. Similar to Alabama, the judge ordered a new map to include an additional majority-minority district. In a 516-page opinion, Judge Steve Jones said that the mapmakers had manipulated voting districts to dilute black voting power and that an additional black majority district should be drawn in West Atlanta. Georgia's population is 33.1% black as of 2022 and growing. In metro Atlanta, African Americans account for 36% of the population. Jones ordered that the racially gerrymandered map be redrawn by December 8th, and that if the state could not comply, the court would draw the map. Governor Brian Kemp has called a special session of the legislature for November 29th. While this is good news for black Georgians, anti-voter legislators may try to delay a new fair map prior to the 2024 election by taking it to the federal appeals court and potentially the U.S. Supreme Court. Judge Jones wrote in the opinion, "The court reiterates that Georgia has made great strides since 1965 toward equality in voting. However, the evidence before this court shows that Georgia has not reached a point where the political process has equal openness and equal opportunity for everyone." Find the decision and the current map at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Public interest in mycology, the study of fungi from mold to mushrooms, is aiding conservation work for species of fungi. The Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew find only 0.4% of global fungi species have been assessed for conservation. Experts feel this interest stems from new empathy for fungal species rather than passing them off as weird or gross. Patricia Kashian with the New York State Museum describes what's needed for proper fungi conservation efforts to go forward.
So I think it's important just to have more and more surveys of fungi at the state level or at even more local levels that occur year after year so that we can sort of track these changes over time.
The hope is people will see fungi's role in keeping habitats safe from climate change. A 2023 study finds underground networks of mycorrhizal fungi on plant and tree roots can capture large amounts of carbon to store in soil. This helps soil retain carbon, which the United Nations says is important since 90% of Earth's topsoil will be degraded by 2050 due to intensive farming practices. But the biggest challenge to increasing fungi conservation is funding. California has provided funding for a statewide mycological conservation survey. And Gabriella D'Elia with the Fungal Diversity Survey says another challenge is the array of unknowns about fungi and how they're cataloged.
You know, there's all kinds of repositories for different biodiversity checklists and things like that in the states. And the fact is that fungi are just more often neglected and not really known how to work with.
She's hoping to see efforts like the one in California come to New York. D'Elia feels New York's plan to conserve 30% of state lands by 2030 provides an opportunity for inclusion of fungi surveys. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. This story was produced with original reporting from Brianna Drexler for Yes Magazine.
And now, here is your WGXC weather update. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Tuesday, it will be sunny with a temperature high near 47 degrees. On Tuesday night, a slight chance of rain and snow showers after 2 a.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 32 degrees. And on Wednesday, a slight chance of showers, partly sunny with a temperature high near 45 degrees. And on Wednesday night, mostly clear with a temperature low of around 28 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, in Greene and Columbia counties.
I'm safe.